For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Coming up on today's show, we've got Mike Viking with his book My Hygge Home, How to Make Your Home a Happy Place. We've got bite-sized self-help tips from Professor Richard Wiseman. We'll be taking a listen to the audio version of Everything I Know About Love by Dolly Alderton. And we've got the books of your life from Booker shortlisted author Percival Everett. That's all to come on today's Read On. Available commercially now, and thanks to Penguin, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, is My Hygge Home, the follow-up to The Little Book of Hygge by Mike Viking. The book is read by Mike himself.
Be mindful of hygge washing. One of my favorite TV shows is Mad Men. If you don't know it, it is set in the advertising industry in the 60s. The main character, Don Draper, declares, "Advertising is about one thing, happiness." So I can almost put it down as research and watch it with good conscience. In the episode The Gold Violin, the head of the ad agency, Bertram Cooper, points out the foundation of the advertising business. People buy things to realize their aspirations, he says, pointing to a Rothko painting he has just purchased. And indeed, there have been many adverts that rely on happiness as the main creative concept. The concept of happiness in adverts is in fact so common that in 2016, Coca-Cola decided to drop their Open Happiness slogan from 2009 because happiness is overused. The greatest threat to capitalism is everyone feeling happy enough that they no longer need to buy anything to make them so, which means that staying at home and finding comfort and joy in what you already have is an act of rebellion. This is what hygge is truly all about, living the good life on a tight budget. It is the enjoyment of simple pleasures. It is the art of creating a nice, warm, comforting atmosphere.
Mike Viking reading from his book My Hygge Home. For Read On, he spoke to Polina Kahurev.
Hygge. What is it and how can this little Danish and Norwegian word help improve our happiness and well-being? Well, Mike Viking is the founder of the Happiness Research Institute in Denmark and also an author of the international bestseller The Little Book of Hygge. Well, in his latest book, My Hygge Home, Mike shares his best tips for how to implement hygge into our homes and create a happy spaces. Well, Mike, it is so lovely chatting with you again. How are you?
Good, thank you, Paulina. Thanks for inviting me back.
No, it's lovely. I love talking all things hygge, but for someone who maybe doesn't really know what hygge is, I know in English-speaking countries, we have a tendency to, I guess, oversimplify it by saying hygge is coziness, but it's not as simple as that, is it?
I would argue that it's a little bit more complex. That's one word. If we were to say two words, I would say consciously cozy. And if I'm allowed more words, I would give an example of when I experienced hygge quite a few years ago now. But I was in Sweden with a group of friends, and we had been out hiking in the afternoon, but came back to the cabin. It was December, so it got dark in sort of mid-afternoon, and we got back into the cabin. And we lit the fire. There was a fireplace in the cabin, and we had also prepared a stew, so we got that boiling on the stove. But other than that, we were just sort of relaxing, sitting in our comfy clothes, enjoying a glass of wine and each other's company. And then one of my friends said, "Could this be any more hyggelig?" Which is the adjective. And then one of the other ones said, "Yes, if there was a storm outside," because hygge is also this feeling of being sheltered from the outside. And I thought it was a Danish thing, but you mentioned the little book of hygge. Well, it's been translated into 38 languages. And I receive letters on a weekly basis from people around the world saying, I've been having hygge all my life. I just didn't know there was a word for it. So I think we just gave a universal human emotion a word. It used to be a Danish word, but now I think it's a global word.
Do you think hygge is a little bit like, I guess, a quiet happiness? And because we're all searching for happiness, we're so drawn to it.
You're definitely right. We're all drawn to happiness. We're all in pursuit of happiness. So my first colleague was Aristotle. He worked with the same questions more than 2,000 years ago that I'm working with today. And he said, happiness is the ultimate aim for human existence. Now, I've been working with happiness not for 2,000 years, but for 10 years. And I've been having a lot of conversations with people around the world. And we're all looking for the good life. And then your second point is hygge, a quiet form of happiness. I think you might also be right in that one. It's not the sort of big sort of American fireworks, you know, finishing the marathon, I don't know, kind of happiness, but it's a quiet happiness, as you say, or it's sort of an everyday happiness. It's enjoying a book and a glass of wine when there is a storm outside. It's connecting with family and friends over a good hearty stew or whatever you prefer to put on the table. And the new book is essentially about what turns a house into a home. So how do we create places where we feel relaxed, where we feel safe, where we feel connected to other people and ourselves? So I think that is what hygge is. Perhaps you're right, a quiet form of happiness or a pursuit of everyday happiness.
I guess that's just another definition to add to many ways of describing hygge, isn't it?
Exactly.
So why did you decide to focus, or I guess narrow down, because you do so much research around hygge, around happiness, why did you decide to narrow it down to that private space of our homes?
I think for a couple of reasons. So the idea for the book actually started quite a few years ago when a Canadian reader of mine told me that he had read the little book of hygge. And because there's so much focus on lighting and candles in that book, he went out and he bought some candle holders. And he started to light candles for dinner at home. And him and his wife have three teenage sons. And when this guy, he started to light candles for dinner, his teenage boys, they started to tease him. Dad, what's going on with the candles? Do you want to have some romantic time with mom? Should we leave? But eventually the boys, they actually started to light the candles for dinner. And he says, now our family dinners last 15 to 20 minutes longer because candles puts the boys in a different mode, a storytelling mode. It changes the atmosphere around the table. So instead of just sitting down, shoveling down their food, they sit down, they sip their wine, and they talk about their day. And I thought, you know, I don't think candles are going to change the world, but I did think, isn't it interesting how a little change in how we eat dinner as a family and how we sort of design the table, how that changes how a family interact. And what other things can we look at from a sort of an architecture of happiness perspective that would help us achieve well-being and quality of life? So that was the sort of original idea. And then I actually wrote it during the pandemic. It was then, it still is now, perhaps even more a turbulent world. There's a lot going on globally that I do not have control over. But I do have some sort of control over or influence over, you know, what happens within these walls? What do I put on the table tonight? And what's the atmosphere going to be around the table? I think it's also a way for us to focus on the zone of control or influence that we do have and help us sort of basically stack the deck in our favor when it comes to well-being. And I think people will recognize that they feel different in different places. And I think that's a sort of a global human phenomenon that we are not isolated from the places we are in, but where we are also impact what we do and how we feel. And the book goes into that.
And it makes complete sense, because when you think about it, for years, office spaces and workspaces have been looking into designing those areas for best productivity and happiness for staff. So it makes sense that you apply that same concept, but to your home, to create what I think you often refer to as a safe zone, a place of somewhere you can escape to and feel relaxed and happy and content and really, really just safe.
Yeah.
Because that's ultimately one of the core things I think everyone needs, isn't it? Safety and security.
It is one of the sort of very foundations. If you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's at the very sort of foundation of his pyramid. We've looked at this at the Happiness Research Institute. We've done several studies around how our homes and houses impact our well-being. We can see that we like to be part of a community. We like to feel part of a small village. We like that we are on a first name basis with our neighbors. We like to be able to borrow a cup of sugar from them, etc. But we also all seem to have a need to be able to retreat to privacy and to be just ourselves. And our homes provide the opportunity to do that if we, again, design them right. So yeah, the privacy, security, safety, core basic human needs.
And you know what I like about your book? Because often when you think about, you know, those books about designing your home, it often can feel like quite expensive solutions, but you don't really have it. It's a mix of things you can do that might, some of them might not even cost you anything, but just some nicely spent time.
Yeah. I'm glad you read it that way, because I agree. And now we've given a lot of different definitions of what hygge is. I think another one would be the good life on a low budget. that hygge is about finding inexpensive way to enjoy life. And I think it's also interesting when you ask people in the UK, there is a survey that I refer to in the book. When you ask people in the UK, what turns a house into a home? Nobody mentions stuff in the top five. I think the first thing that people mention is a sofa. I think it's on seventh place. But the first things that turn a house into a home is love. It's a sense of belonging. It's the sound of laughter. It's the smell of good food cooking. It's something that doesn't have to cost a lot. And I think that's especially relevant these days where we see cost of living going up. And in the book, I also talk about, you know, how can we sort of save on food preparation and reduce food waste, because there's nothing hygge about wasting food.
Mm. Which actually brings me to a question I really wanted to ask, because you in the book say hygge is all about enjoying the process, taking things slow, which you touched upon a little bit, but I think in this case, in the chapter, you were talking in relation to pickling produce and preparing food for wintertime. And I feel like all of those things about taking things slow and enjoying the moment and living in the moment are very connected to mindfulness. So do you think there's that connection between hygge and mindfulness as well?
I think there are definitely some parallel things. Both focuses on the importance of presence, both focuses on the importance of slowness. But I think the origins are different, where mindfulness perhaps is something more, something you actively do or set aside time for. You have a mindfulness session, you go to your yoga studio and do mindfulness. I think hygge is something that is just inherently part of everyday life. So I think there are similarities, but also differences.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about happiness, coziness, those really lovely things you mentioned, their companionship, friends, family. I'm going to swivel a little bit, because a big part of your book is actually humor. And in particular, you have a bit of a love for some really cheesy jokes and puns. And I have one right in front of me. And this is in regards to enjoying a good fondue with friends and family. And you started this chapter with, "Sweet dreams are made of cheese. Who am I to disagree?" So how much research do you have to put in for a book to find all those dad jokes and all the puns?
The dad jokes and the horrible puns don't take a lot of research. They just sort of come naturally. It's a flaw. But But no, I like to write in a conversational tone. I like to mix what I think is a great sense of humor and personal anecdotes with the data. When I write, I imagine sitting across from somebody else over dinner, having a nice conversation. And that is what I would do if we were talking over dinner. I would talk about studies, but I would also sort of give personal examples of what we see in the data, and I would mix in great sense of humor. So that's the way I write. But of course, I use a lot of the data and studies and research we do at the Happiness Research Institute. One of the studies that went into this was a study where we looked at, I think it was 13,000 homes in Europe, looking at why some people were happier with their homes than others, and what are sort of the barriers and drivers of happiness in your home. But the thing is, data might convince people, but people struggle more with remembering data. So combining the data with stories, I think, is powerful if we want to people to remember the points of the book 2, 3, 5 years from now. One of my good friends, John Halliwell, who's also a happiness researcher, said to me, data shapes the science, but stories spread the science. So I think finding examples in our personal life of what we see in the data is a good way to communicate studies.
Now, you mentioned the data, and you have quite a few nice colorful charts and graphs and things in the book. Was it easy to translate those into the audiobook format?
I always write in the text what we see in the graphs. And I always do the narration myself for the audiobooks. It's a really good exercise for me, where Danish is my first language and English is my second. I could have used that years ago, because apparently I've been pronouncing tomatoes wrong.
I mean, that sounded correct to me. I'm not sure why they say you pronounced it wrong. How did you say it?
I can't remember whether I actually said tomatoes or tomatoes. I just remember the first time I did the audiobook for the little book of Hygge. My editor jumped in and said, actually, Mike, we pronounce it tomatoes or tomatoes. But I've lost the memory of exactly what it was. But it's always good fun to do the audiobook. It's less glamorous than I thought. This was also, I think, for the little book of Hygge. We do it over a couple of days. But on the first day, the sound guy, Richard, came in and he said, Mike, I'm just going to come in with a couple of bananas, because I can hear your tummy rumbling. I was really hungry. It was before lunch. And it meant I ended up with, eating a lot of bananas and sitting with a pillow on my stomach to cover the noise. So less glamour than I expected, but it's good fun.
And how did you find narrating this book this time around? Because I remember when we spoke about The Little Book of Hygge, you said you would struggle with V's and W's in sequence. And a particular example you gave us was Viking Warrior Review. Can you say it better? Can you say it in your sleep now? How was recording My Hygge Home?
It was... I didn't struggle as much this time, and it's funny you remember that phrase. It's something I've developed, and I actually, when I was biking out to the studio for the audiobook for this one, I was actually practicing that sentence. So I was cycling on the bike paths and murmuring the Viking Warrior Review. I don't know what my co-cyclists must have thought, but it wasn't as difficult this time, and maybe it's because I'm more conscious of it. When I write, that I know I have to do the audiobook later on. So maybe I stay away from writing sentences like that. The book I've struggled the most with, I can't remember whether, it was probably The Art of Making Memories. There was a sentence that included something of negligible importance. And now I'm falling into the trap again. The negligible importance, honestly, we had to do over 80 takes of that sentence. My tongue just tripped every time I had to sort of tackle it.
You know, as a non-native speaker, I completely understand as well. English is not my first language either. So, Mike, we're almost out of time, but I feel like we have time for maybe one last question, which is, of course, what would be your number one tip for creating that cozy, happy hygge home?
And
it can only be one.
I mean, good slow cooked food on the table is sort of the easiest way to get the hygge going. I'm a big fan of food. I like cooking it. I like eating it. I like gathering good people around the table. So whatever favorite dish, get cooking or have people over cook together, that would be a good start. In Denmark, we often talk about something called the ABC for mental health. And ABC stands for act, belong, commit. So doing something active, doing something together with other people and doing something meaningful. And cooking with your family and friends, I can't see anything that's more meaningful. And it's, of course, together with other people. And you are a little bit active because you're in the kitchen. So that ticks all the boxes for me.
That was fantastic advice there, Mike. Thank you so much for sharing all of your hygge knowledge with us. And Mike Viking, the wonderful author of My Hygge Home, How to Make Home Your Happy Place. Thank you for speaking with us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having me, Paulina.
At its heart, hygge is not about expensive things. It is more about an atmosphere, a certain sensation or feeling. And this comes for free in simple, humble forms. Sometimes less is more hygge. Not only did we shake our heads over the misinterpretation of hygge, we formed a council, a hygge council, with the aim of ensuring that hygge was put on UNESCO's intangible cultural heritage list. Spain has flamenco, Italy has pizza baking, Belgium has beer culture, Denmark has nothing on the list. So the hygge council tried to get hygge on the list to protect and preserve the original meaning of the word. Full disclosure, I'm on the council, and yes, we did have pastries for our meetings there. Our first bid failed, but the fight goes on. So when you see anything being sold as hygge, stop and think whether that item is really going to change the atmosphere of your home or bring joy to your life. If it will, great. But hygge is not about having it all. It is about enjoying what you have and enjoying it with the people in your life. It is not about what you have, but the atmosphere you create. It's a state of mind. It's what makes a place feel like home.
My Hygge Home by Mike Viking is available in print and audio commercially and available from RNIB Talking Books. And while we're on the subject of mental health and mindfulness, available from RNIB Library Now is 59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman.
59 Seconds. Think a little, change a lot. Psychologist Professor Richard Wiseman exposes modern-day mind myths promoted by the self-help industry and presents a fresh approach to change that helps people achieve their aims and ambitions in minutes, not months.
A clip of 59 seconds available from the RNIB Talking Books Library by Professor Richard Wiseman. Now, Richard Wiseman, Professor of the Public Understanding of Psychology, said fear is a strange emotion. When it's genuine fear, we don't like it. But we do like to rehearse fear in a very safe environment, like watching scary movies or TV. So, Professor Wiseman, why do we enjoy what you're calling framed fear?
I think it's a very good question, and the research looked at exactly that question. And the answer is that when we are genuinely afraid, we have adrenaline pumping through the body as we get ready to run away or fight or whatever it is. But of course, that is in a negative situation. It is not an enjoyable emotion. What's interesting about roller coasters and scary radio shows and TV programs and so on is that you get the adrenaline, which is rather fun, the thrill of that, but you know deep down that you're in a safe environment. The zombies really aren't going to sort of jump out and actually start attacking you or whatever it is. So you have this kind of rehearsal of fear, but you have the upside of the adrenaline without the downside of actually being in a properly scary, threatening situation.
I suppose the same could be said for scary talking books as well.
Oh, absolutely. Anything. Where there is a sense of you know, putting you in a different situation, a different context. We are humans, incredibly good at imagining ourselves in a particular situation and telling stories to one another. It goes back, you know, many, many years to sitting around the fire telling stories, and many of them being scary. That notion that we can absorb ourselves in a situation, believe that we're actually there, but yet deep down know that we're not, I think is a fascinating psychological state.
What was interesting in the research was the British men who would send their partners down to see to investigate a noise in the night.
It was a phenomenal finding. So this was asking the question, you know, what would you do if you're laying in bed with your partner and you heard a sort of banging downstairs or something? And 1 in 10 men said that what they would do is send their partner, maybe their wife, down to investigate, which is quite a novel approach to fear. You would have thought that hopefully that they might have gone down to find out what was going on. So, yes, that really did kind of surprise us. And it made me laugh as well, actually.
And having a partner seems to be important for watching horror on TV.
Well, watching with others. And so a little bit like laughter, screaming is a social signal. So if you hear something funny and you're on your own, you don't tend to laugh. You obviously find it funny, but you don't laugh. If you're with others, you're far more likely to laugh. It's about letting people know that you got the joke and spreading merriment and so on. Exactly the same with all these sorts of scary experiences. You're more likely to jump and scream and do all those sorts of things, grab the other person and so on, obviously, if you're with others. And that then builds the experience for them because it becomes contagious and they send it back to you and so on. So even the way we respond to these things is actually unconscious. And again, there's a fascinating psychology around it. You'd think you're just screaming because you see something scary. Actually, you're screaming to let other people know you've seen something scary.
Now, I've done some research on talking to blind people about roller coasters, and is there a fear on a roller coaster when you can't actually see how high up you are? And the findings we got was the perception of speed is the scary thing. But do you think these jump scares and the things on TV work as well when you can't see them?
I suspect that some work even better and others don't work so well. So if you take away the visual medium, then obviously you're focusing on the auditory side of things. And so when you're looking at what I think is actually the best type of fear, which is where you're slowly getting drawn into the story, it isn't just somebody suddenly jumping out on the screen, which for me is a kind of cheap thrill. It's sort of like, of course, that's going to make you jump. But I think what's really wonderful about a Victorian ghost story is the one that slowly pulls you in, takes you into that world, and suddenly it's all rather uncanny, and you're not certain exactly what's going on. And I think the voice is very naked for that, you know, because it just sort of takes you in, and you have to use your imagination to immerse yourself in that rather than a film which does all the work for you. I think that's a wonderful art form, and it's one which I think should be celebrated.
In TV and radio dramas as well, you can't underestimate the importance of tense music as well, though.
Oh, absolutely. And also silence. I mean, if something is silent for a short period of time, that can be really quite tense for people because it is mimicking the genuine fear response, which is to go very quiet and go very still. But you can't have it for too long because it gets monotonous. So it's all about balance. I don't think we're ever going to come up with a formula for fear. You know, it's always going to be an art form. But yes, absolutely, the music that slowly draws you into it, absolutely crucial.
What about yourself? Are you a scare junkie?
For certain things, I'm not a roller coaster fan, but I do enjoy haunted houses. I love wandering through those, you know, those things that sort of have at fun fairs and so on. I love ghost trains. So it depends. I do enjoy some horror films, but they tend to be ones with a strong sense of narrative rather than the kind of jump scare ones, which don't really quite do it for me.
You yourself have a YouTube channel that came from your book, Quirkology, and it seems to be very popular with children. Why is that?
I guess we have a lot of psychology on there, and so there's short videos which involve magic tricks or illusions or things that kids can do at home, and started about 10 years ago, actually. So YouTube was just been around for a couple of years when we started, and now we have about 2.5 million followers on it. And it's lovely. I get emails from kids all the time that say the reason why they're studying psychology is because they saw our Quirkology videos on YouTube. So it's a great way of getting getting psychology out there. Sometimes it makes you feel a little bit old when they're saying, oh, you know, I'm in my second year degree in psychology and I've been watching your video since I was 10. But it's a wonderful way, I think, of spreading what is my passion, which is this just love of the human mind and trying to understand the beauty of our complexity, I think.
Now, where did that come from? Because a lot of them do involve not magic, but illusion.
Absolutely. So I used to work as a magician. So for many years, I was going around doing card tricks on stage, doing illusions. And you realize there's a huge amount of psychology within magic. You have to be a good psychologist to fool an audience. You have to know how they think and feel at any one particular moment. And that's how I got into psychology, because of that. So I have a rather odd career path. But I hope some of that passion will come across when people watch the videos and try the tricks out. And maybe, you know, some of those kids will then go, wow, this is interesting. And that will put them on a path to looking into the area a little bit more deeply.
And I've got a question from my son who says, what was the first magic trick you ever learned?
Oh, my goodness. The first one I ever learned, it was I used to go and visit my grandfather. And he would do a trick where I'd put my initials on a coin. It would disappear and appear in a box that was in his pocket. And I used to badger him, say, how on earth could you do this every single weekend? And he said eventually to me, he said, the answer is in the library. He said, there are books in the library on magic. It's in one of those books. So I went there, read everything, eventually found it. And that was the very first trick that I performed. And I still perform it, where the coin disappears, ends up in a box in your pocket. So it all goes back to me visiting my grandfather when I was about 8.
Now, we started off with a clip of your book, 59 Seconds, which is available in the RNIB library. Self-help that actually does work. Before we end, could you tell us why smiling when you're unhappy would help?
That's what's called the facial feedback hypothesis, that you would think that in terms of emotion and facial expression, it's a one-way street, that when you feel happy, you smile. And that is obviously true. However, it turns out that our expressions also affect our emotions. So if you fake it and you put a smile on your face, it instantly cheers you up. It's one of the quickest ways of doing it. And so if people try now, if listeners try it, just smile for around about 20 seconds, they will feel better. And that's what 59 seconds is about. These very quick things that are evidence-based that make a difference to how people think and feel.
Professor Richard Wiseman, thanks so much for joining us today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
59 Seconds by Professor Richard Wiseman is available as an RNIB talking book now, and his other books are available commercially from Audible. For more information on the talking book service, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world. You just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think talking books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. In a moment, we'll have the books of your life from Booker shortlisted author Percival Everett. But now, time for a book review.
Hi, I'm Amelia Hilton, and today I've been reading Everything I Know About Love by Dolly Alderton, available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by the author herself. In her memoir, Sunday Times dating columnist Dolly Alderton recounts falling in love, wrestling with self-sabotage, and finding a job. She also recalls getting drunk, getting dumped, and finding that your mates are always there for you at the end of a very messy night out.
After I stopped seeing Hector, I assumed it would be only a matter of time before Farley and Scott fizzled out. I had been the glue that bonded them, and when I left that grimy block of flats in Notting Hill, I assumed they'd have little left in common. But within a few weeks, Farley dropped into conversation that they were going on a mini break to Cambridge. Jealousy pumped through my blood system and my whole body stung like it was vinegar. I was the one who'd always had a boy on the scene, and yet now she was the one with an actual proper older boyfriend. Not one who wore her knickers into work, not one who made her wear a fishnet body stocking, or didn't know her surname, or only texted her once a week. Farley had a boyfriend who spent more time with her sober than not sober, who took her on mini breaks and rang her instead of texting and wanted to have actual conversations with her. "What's even in Cambridge?" I ranted bitterly to AJ. "What, like a Bella Italia? Well, good luck. Have fun."
This is a book about bad dates, good friends, and recognising that you and you alone are enough.
And so the process began. Every week I went in, and we did detective work on myself to answer the question of how I came to be who I was in 27 years. We did a forensic search of my past, sometimes discussing a thing that happened the night before, sometimes a thing that happened at school in a PE lesson 20 years ago. Therapy is a great big archaeological dig on your psyche until you hit something. It's a personal weekly episode of Time Team, a joint effort of expert and presenter, the therapist Mick Aston, the patient Tony Robinson. We talked and we talked until she posed a cause and effect theory that fitted. Then, crucially, we worked out how to change it.
This book is hilarious, it's sad, it's silly, and it feels really, really refreshingly honest. The main relationship explored in this book is between the protagonist and her childhood best friend Farley. It explores how their closeness and their understanding of each other starts to fall apart as they both move through life at different speeds and start to want different things. And it really moved me to read about the kinds of intensity and the challenges I've experienced in my own female friendships through these characters. It's the first time I've heard a friendship breakup expressed so well and be compared so eloquently to a romantic breakup. While the book does talk a lot about dating and explores the funny and tragic and ridiculous parts of Dolly's romantic life, these things act much more as a lens to explore her own friendships, her sense of self, and her search for validation, which I found was a really refreshing contrast to stories that mostly focus on people looking for romantic relationships in their 20s.
It was the soft touch of this man, his generous heart, the tenderness he showed me that was enough to make me open up. So I told him everything. I gave it all away for nothing. I told him about the heartbreak of my early 20s. I told him about the years I'd spent starving myself in an attempt to gain some control. I told him about the one time I'd been in love, the intimacy that I couldn't bear, the dependence I feared. I told him how my friends, one by one, had fallen in love and left me behind. I told him how my anxiety had crept up on me in catatonic flare-ups since I was a child, how I couldn't stand near windows because I always felt I was moments away from falling to my death. I told him about my best friend's little sister, who I'd grown up with, who was lying in a hospital bed with cancer. I told him that I felt I was in over my head with adulthood, and about my total inability to ring anyone and ask for help. I told him about the ease with which I buried problems in a chaotic rubble of distractions. I only had the right language for my sadness with a stranger. I could only tell these stories in an ephemeral realm of fantasy, in which I had no accountability.
The structure of the book is also very unusual and entertaining, as some of the chapters are focused on individual women in Dolly's life that she's loved. Some of the chapters are just hangover-friendly recipes that go with the end of a particularly wild night described in the last chapter. Some of them were these almost stand-up-like email invites to parties that one of Dolly's friends was hosting. I think maybe my favourite chapters were the ones just titled Everything I Know About Love at Age X, which were bullet point lists summarising in very funny ways the lessons that Dolly had gone through in the previous few chapters, and these were sprinkled throughout the book as it goes through time as well. Although the protagonist is self-admittedly very dramatic and sometimes takes things to the extreme, I'd recommend this book to anyone of any gender who is or has been through their 20s. Even if you don't find it relatable, it's heartfelt, it's funny, and the structure means that it's really easy to enjoy in small sections.
I would like to pause the story for a moment to talk about Nothing Will Change. I've heard it said to me repeatedly by women I love during my 20s when they move in with boyfriends, get engaged, move abroad, get married, get pregnant. Nothing will change. It drives me bananas. Everything will change. Everything will change. The love we have for each other stays the same, but the format, the tone, the regularity and the intimacy of our friendship will change forever.
There are lots of other great books in the RNIB library, in audio and braille. For more information, call 0303 123 9999 or head to rniblibrary.com.
Thanks to Amelia Hilton, and we'll have more book reviews from her coming soon. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Last week we heard the books of your life from Booker shortlisted author Noviolet Bulawayo. This week it's time for Percival Everett. Here's a short clip from his interview. RNIB has worked with the Booker Prize Foundation for over a decade to ensure that some of the best novels are made available to blind and partially sighted people. Book titles are not always automatically produced in alternative reading formats such as audio or braille, which means that people with sight loss often have to wait much longer to get hold of the latest and most popular books. With funding from the Booker Prize Foundation, we make sure the shortlisted titles in the Booker Prize are produced in all formats as close to the shortlist announcement as is possible. On that shortlist is Percival Everett's The Trees. Although the author himself would never actually describe it as any of these things, it has been called a satire, a zombie novel, and a novel of revenge. It's set in Money, Mississippi, a real place where the 14-year-old Emmett Till was lynched in 1955 after being accused by a white woman of making suggestive remarks. Are the lynched dead coming back for revenge on the descendants of those horrible crimes? And can detectives from the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation, the MBI, get to the bottom of the mystery? The audio version of the book is read by Bill Andrew Quinn.
Deputy Sheriff Delroy Digby was driving his 12-year-old Crown Victoria squad car across the Tallahatchie Bridge when he received a call to go to small change. He pulled into the front yard of Junior Milam and saw the man's wife, Daisy, pacing and crying, gesticulating wildly. Delroy had dated Daisy briefly in high school, and it had stopped when she actually bit his tongue. Then he went into the Army and became a clerk in the Quartermaster's Corps. He returned home to Mississippi to find Daisy married to Junior and pregnant with her fourth child. That child was on her hip as she paced now, and the other three were sitting like zombies on the first step of the porch. "What's going on, Daisy?" Delroy asked. Daisy stopped waving her arms and stared at him. Her face was crunched from crying, her eyes red and sunken. "What is it? What happened, Daisy?" he asked. "The room all the way in the back," she said. "It's Junior. Oh, Lord, I think he's dead," she whispered so the children couldn't hear. "He got to be dead. We all just got back from the big swap meet in the Sam's Club parking lot. The babies ain't seen nothing. Lord, it's just awful."
A clip of The Trees by Percival Everett, read by Bill Andrew Quinn. Percival Everett joined me down the line from his home in LA and somewhat reluctantly told me about the book.
Well, I'm probably the last person to offer a synopsis of any of my books, but I'll try. This novel starts in Money, Mississippi, the site of a horrific lynching of a 14-year-old black young man in 1955. It's not about that event, but that is the seed of the event. And we progress from there with the descendants of the perpetrators of that crime. And it's, I've been told that it's kind of a revenge novel. I don't seek to put labels on any of my work, but I can certainly see why someone would say this.
There ain't no more cane on this breast.
And I believe it was a song that was responsible for the spark that began this book.
It's true. It's a traditional song, I should say. It's a very old song called Ain't No More Cane. And one morning I was listening to a version of a cover of that song by the American country singer Lyle Lovett. And I was actually moved by it. And some of the things I'd been thinking about fell into place. And so I credit Lyle Lovett's version of that song for the beginning of this novel.
And also the song Rise Up.
Rise Up is a kind of version of that same song. They share some lyrics.
Rise up, dead man, help me dry my bones.
And it was a thought that why don't these victims start rising up?
I guess in this.
But it's not a zombie book because you don't like zombies.
Well, who likes zombies? I don't know. Again, it's not for me to say. If someone accused me of having written a zombie book, there are people who like zombie books, so I can go with it.
Lynching and humor seem like very odd bedfellows, but it seems to work.
Well, this is America. Who doesn't like a good lynching? I think all of us oppressed, and even those who aren't as oppressed, get through this life by addressing it with some amount of irony. And so that's what's present in the novel.
Now, lynchings aren't really widely known as history in the UK. Is it the same in the US, or is it very much present there?
Well, I suppose one of the things my novel seeks to do is to point out the fact that lynching is not synonymous with hanging. It means mob violence, mob killing. And that very killing has always been and continues to often be sanctioned by the use of police violence. So I equate police murder of people as lynchings as well.
Sanctioned not only by the police, but by society, because there were postcards sent at the time. And
oh, yes. Yeah, it was culturally sanctioned. People would show up in droves to watch a lynching.
And some of those people may still be alive today.
And you wonder what they think of themselves. You know, that was part of the seed of the novel, too. Looking at some of those photographs and seeing some of those smiling white faces, I wondered, what would this man tell his grandchildren with the world changing around him? How would he address this behavior?
And now here's Percival Everett with the books of his life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, of course, there are many. My first real love of any fiction was with Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, as a very small child. And then when I was 9, from my father's shelf, I grabbed Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage, thinking that I wasn't supposed to be reading it. And of course, I read it secretly and felt scandalous and excited about it, though, of course, no one would have cared. To me, everyone would have cared. And it gave me a lesson about reading, that it's the most subversive thing we can do. When no one knows what the words are doing when they enter us. No one can read over our shoulders or hear what we hear. This is why fascist regimes seek to burn books, because a populace that reads is a populace that thinks.
The day broke grey and dull. The clouds hung heavily, and there was a rawness in the air that suggested snow. A woman servant came into a room in which a child was sleeping and drew the curtains. She glanced mechanically at the house opposite, a stucco house with a portico, and went to the child's bed.
"Wake up, Philip," she said.
She pulled down the bedclothes, took him in her arms, and carried him downstairs. He was only half awake.
"Your mother wants you," she said.
She opened the door of a room on the floor below and took the child over to a bed in which a woman was lying. It was his mother. She stretched out her arms, and the child nestled by her side. He did not ask why he had been awakened. The woman kissed his eyes, and with thin, small hands felt the warm body through his white flannel nightgown. She pressed him closer to herself.
"Are you sleepy, darling?"
she said. Her voice was so weak that it seemed to come already from a great distance. The child did not answer, but smiled comfortably. He was very happy in the large, warm bed, with those soft arms about him. He tried to make himself smaller still, as he cuddled up against his mother, and he kissed her sleepily. In a moment he closed his eyes and was fast asleep. The doctor came forwards and stood by the bedside.
"Oh, don't take him away yet,"
she moaned.
That's Christopher Oxford reading Of Human Bondage by W. Somerset Maugham, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, as is, of course, Peter Pan. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
Oh, well, I live in Los Angeles, so we don't get very many rainy days. This is going to sound like a really obtuse answer, but I often read philosophy instead of, or math instead of fiction. And just to relax and to play, I really like looking at almost anything written by Bertrand Russell, whether it's Why I Am Not a Christian to the Mathematica Principia, which is all symbolic logic, but I just like thinking.
The ending of the war enabled me to avoid several unpleasant things which would otherwise have happened to me. The military age was raised in 1918, and for the first time I became liable to military service, which I should, of course, have had to refuse. They called me up for medical examination, but the government, with its utmost efforts, was unable to find out where I was, having forgotten that it had put me in prison. If the war had continued, I should very soon have found myself in prison again as a conscientious objector. From a financial point of view also, the ending of the war was very advantageous to me. While I was writing Principia Mathematica, I felt justified in living on inherited money, though I did not feel justified in keeping an additional sum of capital that I inherited from my grandmother. I gave away this sum in its entirety, some to the University of Cambridge, some to Newnham College, and the rest to various educational objects. After parting with the debentures that I gave to Eliot, I was left with only about £100 a year of unearned money, which I could not get rid of as it was in my marriage settlement. This didn't seem to matter, as I'd become capable of earning money by my books. In prison, however, while I was allowed to write about mathematics, I was not allowed to write the sort of book by which I could make money. I should therefore have been nearly penniless when I came out, but for the fact that Sanger and some other friends got up a philosophical lectureship for me in London. With the ending of the war, I was again able to earn money by writing, and I've never since been in serious financial difficulties, except at times in America.
That's John Richmond reading from the autobiography of Bertrand Russell, one of a number of volumes available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Well, there is. Jing Su's Kingdom of Characters. An American academic, she's Chinese, is a wonderful book about the Chinese language and how so much work had to be put into making it accessible for use with the rest of the world. Chinese being a very different language that's not phonetic, even to the point that the creation of a Chinese typewriter was a remarkable event.
Kings, clerics, adventurers, scholars, modern poets, and theorists of language were drawn to its strangeness and exceptionality, looking for a key to unlock its secrets through grammar and compositional laws. 16th-century Jesuit missionaries labored to learn it. 17th-century savants were fascinated by it, and 18th-century sinologists fetishized it. How an entire civilization outside of Christendom evolved to have a writing system as complex and massive as a Chinese script has been an enduring linguistic mystery for outsiders. This inquiry poorly masks a deep suspicion. How can a people who read and write in characters ever think the way we do? Even in the late 20th century, views like this were touted by Western experts in different fields. Alphabetic thinking, social theorists would say, explains the advent of the scientific revolution in the West. A modern theorist of networks and the digital age sees the alphabet as a conceptual technology that forms the bedrock of Western science and technology. A scholar of ancient Greece saw the signs much earlier at the fount of Western civilization, where the alphabetic mind was responsible for all the West's accomplishments. Joseph Needham, a renowned British historian of Chinese science, spent his life's work defending scientific inventions in ancient China against claims like these. But he also recognized that the Chinese language remained the greatest barrier for Westerners to understanding the minds of the Chinese. It is China's first and last Great Wall.
That's Jing Zhu reading from her book Kingdom of Characters, a tale of language, obsession, and genius in modern China. It's available both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Percival Everett, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've got time for on today's show, but remember this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.